disliked my actions, perhaps he would finally be roused to speak to me. The food tasted so delicious it was hard to limit myself to only a small portion of each dish, but I wanted to try everything. I wished I could let Lily know that at the very least I had a warm bed and a full stomach. Loneliness crashed over me. I had never been without a built-in best friend before. Several tears slid down my cheeks, and for the first time I felt grateful I was completely alone. At least there was no one to witness my grief. As I reached to wipe the moisture away, the rustle I had heard earlier in the corridor swept through the room. It sounded so much like whispering that I twisted, searching the room with my eyes. I was still alone. I stood up abruptly and my chair crashed backwards onto the floor. Feeling foolish, I picked it back up before hurrying from the room. I had eaten too much already, and I needed to find a way to communicate with my sister. Chapter 5. I wandered through the castle for a long time before I managed to find the tallest tower. The invisible whispers followed me. At first, I got hopelessly lost, wandering through an endless maze of interconnected corridors and rooms. The castle had clearly been expensively and elegantly decorated at some point, but unlike my room, the majority of it had fallen into dusty disrepair. The contrast indicated that someone had clearly prepared for my arrival. I remembered the line of light that had led me to my room. What sort of strange curse was this? Was the castle itself responsible for its own care? I shook my head at the fanciful thought. How could a magic building have fed and groomed my horse? But the gloomy, shadowy castle, combined with the whispers all around me, fed the mad imaginings. Perhaps it had not been the curse that had warped the beast's mind. Perhaps living here for so long alone had done it. I shook my head. No. The beast wasn't mad. He had written coherent letters, after all. He was evil. He must be evil to have brought down such a curse upon himself. And I had seen the evidence myself in the cruelty of the events of the Princess Tawny, the Tawny he had called and that had, therefore, been magically shaped to fit him. The darkness he had brought to these lands had nearly overtaken Marin, and all the other kingdoms still stood in danger. And yet here he sat, holed up in his strange castle, carelessly destroying the lives of innocent girls he had never even met. If the castle was dark and terrifying, it had been he who had made it that way, and not the other way around. What did the beast do to curse himself and his kingdom? I wondered for the thousandth time. I shook off the thought. Filling my head with horrifying theories wouldn't help me fix my projections or find the truth. I needed proof, and I had a whole castle in which to search for it. After a while of aimless wandering, I remembered again that the lights had led me to my room. Perhaps a friendlier power dwelt here alongside the beast. He had certainly shown no effort to see to my comfort. "I'm looking for the tallest tower. Could you show me the way?" It felt foolish to speak the words aloud to the empty air, but it could hardly hurt. I had no immediate response, and no candle sprang to life to lead me. But I soon noticed a strange phenomenon. When I moved toward the whispers rather than away from them, I seemed to find more open doors and staircases. I began to listen for them, and soon I found myself in an enclosed staircase that spiraled upwards. As I climbed stair after stair, I caught glimpses through a series of small windows of what appeared to be a second staircase, somehow twisted around mine, and every time I passed the openings, I heard the whispers. I tried to calm my breathing, which kept speeding up despite my best efforts. The whispers appeared to be friendly, but the sound created the inescapable impression that I was ascending upwards in tandem with an unseen group of people. I shivered. I needed this to work. The familiar sound of Lily in my mind would drive away the eeriness of this empty castle. But it took only a moment to discover that height made no difference to the wall that blocked my thoughts. I threw them out anyway, again and again. At first I did it out of frustration, but then I began trying to pinpoint the exact feeling of the obstruction. I had never experimented like this before, and it was unexpectedly interesting. I had always assumed that we had a direct connection and placed our thoughts straight into each other's minds. But it now seemed more complicated than that. Clearly our thoughts travelled to each other. I focused on the sensation of my thoughts flying out from my mind. I felt the way they stayed connected to me. But at the same time, I couldn't shake an underlying unease. I sat on the floor of the top tower room, put my chin on my hands and chewed on a strand of hair. After extended thought, I decided the discomfort came from the sense of being unanchored. My thoughts had always stayed attached to me, yes, but usually they also attached immediately to someone else. My sister. A tether on the other end. I now felt loose, floating in the world without foundation. The whispers swirled around me, reaching a crescendo. For a moment, I thought I could make out individual words, but meaning eluded me. I shivered, unnerved, but then reminded myself that the sounds had helped me find my way. They had been friendlier than my betrothed, in fact. A chuckle escaped me. I hadn't even been gone from Marin a week, and I was already counting disembodied, inaudible whispers as my only friends. "Not that I'm not grateful," I said aloud. "In fact, I'd greatly appreciate it if you could show me the way back to my room." A low murmur surrounded me and then moved toward the door. I clambered to my feet and followed the sound. Sure enough, it led me down several flights of stairs and through a series of corridors, and delivered me to my room. I smiled as I opened the door. I might not have broken through to Lily, but I had learned a small something of the secrets of the castle, and a particularly helpful something, too, given the size of the building and its confusing layout. As soon as my eyes fell on my bed, the smile dropped from my lips. The bed had been made and my possessions tidied, but it was the piece of parchment resting against my pillow that filled my heart with dread. I walked slowly over and picked it up. "You will join me for the evening meal." The note hadn't been signed, but the handwriting was easily recognizable from his earlier missives. The curt command made me tremble with rage. At every turn the beast was determined to strip away my freedom. I immediately determined not to go. Several hours later, as I once again paced up and down my room, I doubted my decision. I wished I could consult Lily. My stomach had started reminding me that I hadn't eaten since the morning, and when I had hopefully asked the room if a meal might be forthcoming, nothing had happened except a brief swirl of whispered noise. The murmuring sounded more distressed than usual, but no assistance appeared. I lay down on top of the covers and let my head sink into the pillows. My defiance had seemed entirely justified when I first read the note, but perhaps I had been too hasty. I needed to understand the curse and the beast if I was to find a way around the betrothal. And what better source could there be than my betrothed himself? As the last ray of sunset pierced my window, I scrambled off the bed and hurried over to the wardrobe. The doors flung themselves open before I could touch them, and for the first time, I smiled at the strange behaviour of the castle. I hoped it meant I had been right. A second power existed here, and it wished to help me defeat the beast. A breeze rushed through the room and rustled one particular dress. I pulled it out and examined it, frowning. I could tell, even without trying it on, that the soft material would fall flatteringly, clinging to my torso and waist before swishing elegantly around my hips and out into a small train. But I felt no need to dress up for the part monster who was essentially my captor, and the room's desire for me to do so made me question my earlier assumption as to whose side it was on. But as I reached to return it to the wardrobe, my hand stilled. The beast insisted on treating me brusquely, as if I had no position or importance. If I wanted to remind him that I was a princess from a powerful kingdom, then I needed to look the part. Reluctantly, I dressed and examined myself in the full-length mirror. Sure enough, knowing that I looked elegant and regal boosted my confidence. My stomach rumbled, and I hurried from the room in a swirl of satisfied whisperings. As I followed the sounds back to the entrance hall, I told myself that my decision most definitely had nothing whatsoever to do with my hunger, or the delicious food I had been served in the dining hall that morning. My steps slowed as I reached the open door, the glow of flames pouring out into the entrance hall. I took a deep breath and stepped through, half noting the blazing fire in the huge fireplace as my eyes locked onto the hulking form occupying the seat at the head of the table. His shaggy head came up at my entrance, and he pushed back his chair, standing silently. For a brief moment our eyes met, and his piercing blue gaze froze me in place. How could such a monster possess such eyes? He seemed caught off guard by my appearance, a response at odds with his command that I attend the meal. Then I stepped forward, and the unsettling moment was broken. I had to remind myself to be glad when I saw that my spot had been set at the beast's right hand, rather than the distant foot of the table. I had told myself I wished for a chance to speak with him, but in truth I had hoped to have the long table between us. I took my place, and the chair pushed itself in behind me. I noted, distantly, that the moving furniture didn't even surprise me. I was growing accustomed to the oddities of this castle. The scrape of a knife drew my eyes upwards, and I had to suppress a gasp at the sight of the beast's gleaming fangs jutting from his human mouth. Apparently, I had yet to grow accustomed to my betrothed. I quickly looked down again, hoping he hadn't noticed my moment of intimidation. A childish part of me wanted to return his earlier rudeness with silence of my own, but the larger part anticipated our first conversation with reluctant interest. I had spent so much time imagining the motivations and mindset of this man, and yet I had no idea what he would say. But the beast did not speak. Instead, he ate steadily, his hairy hands curling awkwardly around the cutlery. I followed his lead, glad to fill my stomach and gather my composure before launching into the inevitable conflict. The first course gave way to the second, and the glances I stole at him increased in frequency. The strange shape of his mouth clearly made eating difficult, but he persisted without comment. Twice when I looked his way, our eyes met. Both times I looked quickly away and then spent the next minutes trying to interpret the strange expression I had glimpsed on his face. The third time I refused to look down, holding his eyes instead, my own full of defiance. His eyes, as they met mine, seemed to glow, the warmth in them more unsettling than the harsher emotions I had glimpsed previously. Eventually I looked away, hating the faint flush which I could feel staining my cheeks. He had no business having eyes like that. I rushed to cover the awkwardness of the moment, sick of waiting for him to speak. "You may call me Sophie if you like. Everyone does. I only use Sophia for formal occasions." I paused to give him a chance to reply, but he remained silent, so I pressed on. "I suppose you must have been surprised to see me. My kingdom of Arcadia lies far across the seas, one of the four kingdoms. We are large and prosperous, and my family wish to expand our diplomatic and trade ties. My sister Lily and I were part of the delegation sent to Marin to open negotiations. We arrived in time to be caught up in the Princess Tawny, which you called." Surprised was probably an understatement. The four kingdoms had been cut off from these lands for generations. For so long, in fact, that our people had forgotten that a flotilla of ships ever left our shores to seek new lands. Yet, apparently, those ships had sailed away and found these lands, pristine and untouched. And then they beseeched the High King to set a wall of storms between us. Back then it had been the four kingdoms that had forgotten the High King's decrees of true love, and had turned their backs on the godmothers. Those who fled had sought protection from us. In the intervening generations much had changed, and perhaps that was what had caused the storms to disappear, and our lands to find each other once again. Because now the four kingdoms flourished. The godmothers had assisted the rulers of each of the lands to find true love, and, as decreed from the High King's Palace of Light, the result was peace and prosperity for kingdoms ruled by love. Except Lily and I had found peace a little boring, a fact I now heartily regretted. When an emissary had arrived unexpectedly from this unknown land, we had responded to the promise of adventure with enthusiasm. We had joined the return delegation to the Duchy of Meryn, and had found adventure enough in the danger of the Princess Tawny. The ancient laws of this foreign land had worked against us then, even as they protected me now. Thoughts of the Tawny sparked a flare of resentment inside me. Lily and I had suffered in many ways during the competition, and it had nearly sabotaged Lily's chance at true love, all because of this silent creature sitting beside me. A small voice in the back of my mind whispered that it had sabotaged my chance of true love, but I suppressed it. I would find a way free from this forced betrothal, whatever it took. I glanced back at the beast again. I hoped he had absorbed my words about my kingdom. I wanted him to know they would not sit idly by if he attempted to harm me. Should I tell him so outright? Or would such plain speaking spur him to anger? I weighed the risks either way. While I considered, the silence between us lengthened. I had moved past anger into incredulity at this point. Did he really intend never to speak to me? What purpose could he have in such behaviour? He had been the one to summon me, although I could hardly imagine why, based on his actions so far. I had feared on the journey here that he might expect too great an intimacy, but the opposite seemed to be true. He did not even want the most basic of interactions. But, on the other hand, he had demanded my presence at the meal. The contradictions made little sense, and I was sick of feeling uncertain and confused. I had tried being rude on the night of my arrival, and I had now twice tried being polite. I would ask him directly for an explanation. Of the Tawny, of his curse, of his behaviour. I opened my mouth to do so just as he shifted toward me. The huge bulk of his shoulders rippled with strength as his large hand stretched out. I remembered we were alone, and how capable he would be of crushing me, and closed my mouth again. A strange energy coursed through the huge, mostly empty room. The flames made the shadows dance and weave around me, and the air overly warm. I began to feel I was in a dream. It took me a moment to notice that the beast had been holding another small piece of parchment out toward me. By the time I recognized the object, he had dropped it beside my plate. My hand trembled slightly as I picked it up. "Will you marry me in the morning?"
What?
I leaped to my feet, my chair clattering to the floor behind me for the second time in as many meals. In all my imaginings, I had not considered that he might press for such a quick wedding. Royal weddings took time to prepare, and surely he could not expect me to marry him while I was alone here without support, let alone while he and his kingdom remained cursed.
No!
I almost shouted the word, unable to meet his eyes.
Absolutely not!
I had started to grow a little comfortable in this castle. I had lost the edge of my fear and anger. But the thought of actually marrying my betrothed brought them flooding back. I turned to rush from the room, only to be jerked to a stop just before I reached the door. His large hand, the nails more like claws, easily wrapped around my upper arm and spun me around to face him. He held me close, although not quite pressed against him, his face leaning down toward mine. For a mad moment, I thought he meant to press his lips against mine, and I froze, almost incapacitated by revulsion. But he made no move to close the small distance between us, instead pinning me in place with his eyes and his firm grip on my arm. A strange fascination filled me as his eyes pleaded with me for something I couldn't understand. Only that morning I had resolved never to let him touch me. And yet the surge of energy which ignited me now contained as much intrigue as repulsion. I remembered his hand, soft against the neck of the black stallion. I felt the way his fingers gripped me now, firm and yet not hard enough to hurt. Something about his restrained strength enthralled me in a way I had not expected. What was going on inside the head of such a strange person? Fancy gripped me, and I imagined that his eyes were attempting to tell me, to pour everything from his mind into mine, that they were pleading with me to free him. But then my eyes dropped to his fangs, and I remembered. It was I who needed to be freed. This beast had plucked me from my family, cut off my contact with them, isolated me completely, and now even attempted to physically restrain me. I stepped down hard on his foot, wrenching my arms from his grip at the same time. Shock crossed his face, and I didn't wait for him to regain his balance. Picking up my skirts, I fled from the room as fast as I could run. Chapter 6. I dived into my bed almost as fast as I had done the night before. The chest of drawers again blocked the door, and I had abandoned the gown in a crumpled mess on the floor. The lights had led my way, this time with the whispers swirling around me as well. They had died out into silence now, but I had taken some small comfort from their earlier presence. I tried to tell myself I was not alone, but I didn't really believe it. I was more alone than I had ever imagined being. I had tried to be brave, but I had failed. I acknowledged now that it had been hunger, not bravery or strategy, that had driven me to dinner. And without my twin to back me up and support me, I had lost my courage. She had always led us, and I had always been content to let her. Content because I knew that in truth she needed me as much as I needed her. The thought brought a fresh bout of tears. How was Lily coping back in Marin, as cut off from me as I was from her? But she had John now, and a new place in this foreign land as the future Duchess of Marin. I had seen a new strength grow in her throughout the tourney. I had even used it to fuel my own resolve. But now that she was stripped away from me, I saw that it was not enough. Alone, I was weak, when all I wanted was to be strong. For the second night, my tears soaked my pillow, and I could not will them to stop. Eventually, exhausted from my long day, I slipped into slumber. Once again, I was woken by the sunlight, my curtains still open from the day before. But unlike the previous morning, I didn't have to fight back tears. Apparently, I had finally cried myself out. Or perhaps I was merely distracted by a thought, a thread that had woven its way through my restless dreams. I struggled now to capture it, certain of its importance. I had been haunted all night by the growls and roars and deafening silence of my betrothed, but also by his haunting eyes, pleading with me. And I had been sure of something in my sleep, a realization that I could no longer recall. It took me at least a minute to chase it down, the revelation finally bursting through my mind. My betrothed growled and snarled and roared like an animal, his mouth misshapen to fit beast-like fangs. What if it was not rudeness that drove his silence? What if he was actually unable to speak? I lay in bed for some minutes, considering the idea from all angles. The more I thought about it, the more obvious it seemed, and I began to feel embarrassed for not seeing it before. His notes and his pleading eyes suddenly made sense. I sat up in bed, the new knowledge driving away any lingering melancholy. A new challenge had presented itself, and I felt glad for the distraction. I slipped out of bed, weighing possible means of communication, but paused. A new note had been slipped under the door while I slept. I rushed over to swoop it up, elated by my new understanding. Surely this was a letter from the prince, explaining his incapacity and apologizing for his behavior since my arrival. Of course, I had already worked it out without his explanation, but he couldn't be expected to know that. But the glow of satisfaction died as soon as I opened the parchment and read the words inside. It could not, by any stretch of the imagination, be considered a letter. Instead, it contained only a repeat of his demand from the day before. "You will join me for the evening meal." I stared at it, rereading it three times before crumpling it up and flinging it into the embers of the fire. I had allowed my pleasure at solving the puzzle to blind me for a moment. The rudeness of his curt communications could not be blamed on his inability to speak. It came wholly from him. I should not have let myself forget I was dealing with a beast. I dressed myself in a mood of righteous indignation. Would it really have been so hard to write me a proper letter? I struggled to imagine his clawed hand holding a pen, but pushed the thought aside. However hard it might be for him, it could not compare to the trials I had been through in the tourney. It had most likely been pride that held him back. He had not wanted to admit his limitations, and I felt sure he was not the sort to ever apologize. I chewed my way through the food that had been laid out for me with more force than was necessary. I suspected that if I wanted an evening meal, I would have to eat it in his presence. And a part of me even relished the prospect. I would give him a piece of my mind, and if I was right, he would be entirely unable to answer back. I couldn't resist a small grin at the thought. What girl hadn't wished herself in such a position at some point or other? And in the meantime, I had the whole day before me. Going higher hadn't allowed me to bypass the wall blocking me from Lily, so I couldn't imagine going underground would help. I glanced out the window and admitted to myself that at least some of this conclusion came from the fact that I had no desire to go searching for the dungeons. The sun shone despite the snow, and the open air called to me. Perhaps I needed to leave the boundaries of the castle. It might not be a wall so much as a barrier that blanketed this locality. In my anger and fear, I had assumed it was a specific block against me, but in reality that made no sense. No one even knew of our ability, so why would anyone plan against it? One glance at the snow-filled garden, full of blossoming flowers and glossy fruit, was enough to see that this place existed outside the usual laws of nature. I was becoming increasingly convinced that whatever magic fueled this enchantment blocked my projections by chance. I would take Chestnut and ride far enough beyond the castle to test my theory, but not so far that I might lose my way back. I had not forgotten the conditions in the rest of this kingdom, nor the consequences to myself and my family if I tried to defy the ancient laws that bound my betrothal. Glad for a purpose that would take me outside and into the company of my horse, currently my only friend, I hummed as I hurried my final preparations. I might be talking to Lily again within the hour. Chestnut seemed happy to see me and eager for exercise. I easily found her saddle and fitted it quickly, glad my parents had made me learn how to care for my mount myself. I had been relieved to see no sign of the beast, but confused to still discover no sign of anyone else either. Yet Chestnut's straw was fresh and her coat recently groomed. I thrust off thought of the mystery, too eager to speak to my sister to lend it my full attention. A mounting block outside the stable helped me onto Chestnut's back, and we were soon walking through the gardens. I had intended to move quickly toward the Isle of Orange Trees, but my fascination held me back. I let Chestnut wander through the plants at a walk. The hours spent surrounded by the enchantment of the castle had softened the unease the strange garden had initially produced. I could now see the unusual beauty of it, the colours gorgeous against the pure white of the undisturbed snow. I spotted an intricate rose garden far to my left, and nearly turned Chestnut toward it. But at the same time I saw the first of the orange trees on my right and remembered my purpose. I directed my mare's nose toward the row of trees and urged her into a trot. The warmth of the sun beat against my shoulders, and I marvelled that it did not melt the snow. As we moved into the aisle, I let Chestnut settle back into a walk. I steered her to one side, brushing close against the trees. Clumps of delicate white flowers alternated with plump-looking orange globes. The intoxicating scent of the flowers surrounded me, and I had to stop myself from picking one of the fruit. It looked juicy and delicious, but I didn't know if it was safe to eat something so clearly enchanted. I felt more relaxed than I had since leaving Marin. It was hard to feel stressed or afraid when every sense was flooded with so much beauty. I breathed deeply and closed my eyes. For the first time in days, I felt hope, as I always did amid the beauty of a garden. When I opened my eyes again, I noticed a tall set of iron gates, located at the end of the trees. Both sides were flung open, giving free passage into and out of the aisle. And from the look of the grass growing around the bottom of the metal, the beast was not in the habit of closing them. I hadn't noticed the gates were inside the carriage, but I could hardly be surprised given my state of distraction at the time. Unconsciously, I pushed Chestnut back into a trot, spurred on by the glimpse of freedom ahead.
"Lily, I'm coming!"
I projected, although I knew she would not receive it. Before I reached the gate, however, the sound of pounding hooves drew my attention. Flashing between the trees, I caught glimpses of a huge black horse thundering along outside the aisle. The beast rode his stallion as if the two were one, moving more gracefully together than I had imagined two such giants could. I slowed slightly, unable to tear my eyes from the sight of them. Once again, I found myself captured by the controlled power of the beast. He appeared to be racing to meet me, and for an unthinking moment I felt glad, pleased to have the opportunity to examine his technique more closely. But he didn't give any sign of greeting or turn his mount into the aisle to ride beside me. Instead, just as I neared the gate, he swung his stallion's head sharply, turning him perpendicular to the path I rode. As he crossed the open gateway, he pulled his horse to a sharp halt, the stallion rearing up, his hooves flashing through the air. The beast's roar rang out through the garden, crashing through the still beauty of our surroundings. I scrambled to pull Chestnut up before we were crushed by the stallion's hooves. The mare neighed loudly as I tugged on the reins, lifting her own front hooves as she attempted to pivot away. Brown mane streamed in my face. A black coat flashed before me. Sharp hooves and dark riding boots streaked past, rising and then falling. And then, somehow, we had avoided a collision. Branches and leaves filled my vision as Chestnut, having regained her balance, took off running. She shot between two trees and out into more open ground, racing toward the garden that surrounded the far end of the row of trees. I fought to keep my seat and break through her blind panic. It wasn't the first time a mount of mine had bolted, but it had never happened on such unfamiliar ground. Unaware of potential dangers in the terrain, I struggled to get her quickly back under control. Just as I felt her begin to calm beneath me, the sound of hooves once again filled my ears. I glanced swiftly back, under my arm, and saw the flash of black as the beast raced toward us. Chestnut, hearing the approach, picked her pace back up. I bit back a scream. Was he trying to get me killed? The longer legs of the stallion quickly brought them alongside us. The beast leaned toward me, reaching out with one hand. With shock, I realized his intention. He was attempting to stop Chestnut. In panic, I turned my eyes away from the ground ahead and met his eyes for a fleeting moment. Stop! I screamed with all the air in my lungs. Leave me be! Are you insane? He seemed to falter at the determination and anger on my face. His pace slowed slightly, and I took a deep breath of relief, transferring my full attention back to Chestnut as he fell away. The garden raced toward us, and my heart pounded at her renewed speed. I could feel the unthinking terror filling her, and wondered if I should aim her toward the castle. She would swerve before she hit the building, but would she throw me off in the process? As she leaped over the first of the garden beds, I noticed that the ground rose to one side of the castle. Angling her in that direction, I pointed her uphill and toward the clearest ground I could see. I held my breath as we thundered forward, sitting back in my seat and pulling periodically on the reins. Gradually, I felt her speed shift and slow. As the castle flew past us, she dropped down to a more controlled gallop and then slower still. As we crested the rise, she finally transitioned into a trembling walk. I slumped slightly in the saddle, taking deep, gulping breaths. I closed my eyes for a second, heart still racing from the near disaster. The beast had prevented me from leaving. It was the only explanation that made sense. I narrowed my eyes. He had purposefully blocked my passage and had done so in the most dangerous way possible, without thought for my safety. I wheeled Chestnut back around and walked her to the front steps of the castle. The beast stood there, his stallion's reins in his hand and his eyes on me. It was hard to read the veiled emotion in them, although he was calmer than I had expected. The same couldn't be said of me.
How dare you!
I drew myself up tall, staying on Chestnut's back to give me extra height over the dismounted beast.
You could have killed me! Do not ever attempt to touch my mount again!
My chest heaved with my angry breaths while the beast watched me calmly. After a moment he bowed his head in apparent acquiescence. I felt an ungracious surge of triumph at his capitulation.
And do not attempt to control where I go. We may be betrothed, but I am not your property to order as you will. If I wish to leave the castle, I will.
He froze, not a muscle moving as his eyes tightened. Then he bared his fangs and growled, the sound starting low but gaining quickly in volume. My eyes widened and Chestnut shied, reacting to my tensing legs as much as the noise. She turned her head toward the stable, and I encouraged her to move faster with a further tightening of my knees. As we fled ignominiously, I felt shame course through me. Once again, my courage had failed me. Chapter 7. I trembled the whole time I groomed Chestnut, as the terrified energy of the ride and the tension of the confrontation with the beast drained away. When I finally made it back to my room, I had regained my calm, until I saw a new parchment pushed under the door. You will not leave the castle grounds under any circumstances. It is not safe. The gate will remain closed and locked from now on. Do not try to circumvent it. No details or real explanation. No apology for nearly getting me killed. The new note followed the last one into the fire. There was no way now that I would be attending a meal with him, even if it meant going hungry. As twilight approached, the sound of inaudible whispers filled the room. The wardrobe door rattled and opened, a breeze ruffling the dresses. I resolutely turned away, despite my rumbling stomach. The whispers seemed to grow more agitated, the soft sound growing louder and more discordant. The door of my room swung open, and I strode over and slammed it shut again. The whispers went silent for a moment before bursting out louder than ever. I went over and sat in a chair by the window, staring out into the garden below as the last rays of sunset burnished the flowers. More rattling emanated from the wardrobe, but I resolutely ignored it. Material enveloped me, and I yelped inelegantly, fighting my way free of the many layers. I stood up and glared down at the violet dress which had apparently been dropped on my head. I turned my glare on the room, but, of course, it remained empty.
"Leave me alone," I said out loud. "I'm not going."
More rattling and rustling spread through the room, and my door swung open again, but I continued to glare indiscriminately until it slowly subsided. "If he wants me to eat with him, he needs to learn to ask nicely." A sound more like a sigh than a whisper filled the room, followed by silence and the soft closing of the door. I shook my head. I had been right the night before. The castle seemed committed to my dinners with the beast. I flopped down on my bed. My defiant stance unfortunately meant a night of boredom as well as a night of hunger. I sat up abruptly. The food I had so far eaten had tasted real enough and had filled my stomach. If it was only delivered by the enchantment and not created by it, then there might be a kitchen full of food in here somewhere. A kitchen where I could requisition a meal. Given their recent agitation, I doubted the lights or whispers would be inclined to help me circumvent the beast's orders in this way. But I had spent my entire life in various palaces and castles, and I was starting to get a feel for this one. I suspected I would be able to find my way there eventually. Listening at the door for any hint of movement in the passage outside, I pushed the door partially open and slipped out of the room. I felt a little ridiculous creeping along through empty passageways in a castle that contained only one other inhabitant, and one who was presumably in the dining hall. But somehow, possibly due to wishful thinking, I had begun to think of the Whispers as companions. Slightly misguided ones, perhaps, but company of a sort. And I wasn't entirely sure what they would do if they saw me. I chuckled quietly. If they saw me. Whispers didn't exactly have eyes, and for all I knew they were part of the magic of the castle, in which case I was trying to hide from the walls themselves. But still I trod as quietly as possible, stopping to listen and then peer around each corner. It took me well over an hour to find the kitchens, by which time I was beginning to fear that the beast must be finishing his own solitary meal. And I had no idea where he went when he wasn't riding or eating. The thought made me tread even more carefully. But it also made me more determined. I would not go to sleep with an empty stomach while he satisfied his hunger. When I finally reached a promising doorway, I stuck my head around cautiously. Sure enough, a large kitchen greeted me with a cheerful fire burning in one of the fireplaces. I thought I had become used to the strange ways of the castle, but my knees gave a slight wobble at the sight of plates, cutlery, and food flying around the room. After a moment, I registered the presence of the Whispers. I stood there motionless, until a sort of pattern emerged. The remains of a delicious-looking feast were cleaning themselves up, scraps making their way into scrap buckets of their own accord and dishes washing themselves. If I hadn't felt so unnerved, I would have laughed at the comical sight. "I wish you could see this, Lily," I projected into the nothingness. "I wish you were here." The Whispers seemed to rise in volume as I thought of my sister, although still stopping short of any clear meaning. I sat just outside the doorway and let myself fall into the grip of sadness and loneliness. What was the point of new sights and adventures if I had no one to share them with? A loud crash and a renewed surge of whispers distracted me from my melancholy. Peering into the room once more, I saw that shards from a large dish now lay scattered across the floor. I could almost hear a recriminatory tone to the sound of the whispers, and they sounded so much like words that I listened intently, hoping to decipher something. They had become much louder since I had first encountered them, and I didn't understand how I was still unable to hear any words amid the rustling, murmuring sound. I held my breath, tipping one ear toward the kitchen, but still the sound seemed to slip past my consciousness. I thought again of my twin and all the theories she would have about this odd place, and a sudden thought struck me. I had put plenty of effort into connecting with her, throwing my projections out in her direction, but I hadn't put the same experimentation into listening. Perhaps if I could not reach her, she could still reach me. It was a more difficult prospect, of course, because it required that she be attempting to reach me at the exact moment that I was attempting to listen. But the more I understood and perfected my ability to listen, the more likely I would hear her next time she projected. The thought excited me enough that I didn't want to wait. I settled myself more comfortably against the wall and closed my eyes. At first I strained my ears, as I had done moments before, and I had to remind myself that I had never used my mouth or ears to project with Lily. Instead, I tried to clear my mind and focus on what it felt like to hear her voice in my mind.
"Hurry up!"
I flinched with shock at the clear words. "Lily?" I responded instinctively, reaching out for our familiar connection. But instead I hit the mental wall, feeling nothing but a cold emptiness where my usual sense of my sister lay. I took a deep breath, shaking slightly from shock. I had heard the words. I wasn't sure I hadn't imagined them. I replayed them in my mind and realized the voice had sounded nothing like Lily's, and the words themselves made no sense. I closed my eyes and listened again, this time focusing on the sensation of making my mind receptive, of opening it to whatever path my projections travelled. I made no effort to cast my own thoughts out, and I similarly put away all thought of my sister or the familiar cadence of her thoughts.
"If you weren't so busy gossiping, Tara, you wouldn't have dropped the platter. Now what are we to use to serve the prince's potatoes?"
"Yes," I cheered myself silently.
"Oh, hush, Gilda, you're always complaining. The castle has 100 platters." "Watch your tongue, girl, or I'll make sure you're sent out to the stables to shovel manure."
As an outraged gasp sounded inside my mind, I carefully peered back into the kitchen. Most of the food had been cleared away, but a dish hung frozen half inside a large sink of water, and several other items hung in various positions around the room.
"You're not head chef yet, Gilda," a third voice entered the conversation, deep and slow. "So don't get ahead of yourself."
"I'm just trying to keep order, Matthew."
The Gilda voice sounded grumpy, but she offered no further comment, and the various frozen objects began to move again. I swallowed and whipped my head back out of sight. For a long moment I simply sat there, making no effort to move or even to listen. Now that I had stopped trying, the inaudible whispers sounded again. I closed my eyes and pictured the scene in the kitchens. Apparently, it was spirits who served the beast and his castle. I shivered. Except the conversation hadn't sounded much like otherworldly spirits. In truth, Gilda sounded very like a head chambermaid from my own palace who had always secretly terrified me a little. And Matthew had sounded so much like a stable master that I could almost picture him. They certainly sounded nothing like spirits. I considered another interpretation. Invisible servants. I chewed on a fat curl of hair while I rolled the idea over in my mind. So many things began to make sense. The missing people of Palinar. The doors that opened themselves. My guides through the castle. The unmanned coach. Even the words I had heard my first night in the coach when I had been half asleep, my mind relaxed. A new thought hit me, and two tears leaked down my face unheeded. I was not alone here with the beast, after all. I had a whole castle of potential companions, if I could only find a way to communicate with them. Seeing them would be nice too, but definitely secondary. A tiny part of me felt sad to realize that no magical force had been assisting my efforts to defeat the beast, but I thrust it aside. The inhabitants of the castle had helped me when I had asked, which suggested they were friendly, and I preferred a friend to an inhuman magical purpose, even if that magic was helping me. I reached out with my mind for the voices I had heard, trying to connect with their conversation, but I heard nothing. I frowned and tried again. Still nothing. The sensation of reaching out for Lily and connecting with her mind felt so familiar that I couldn't understand why it wasn't working now. I tried again without success. I couldn't even hear the whispers now. I stopped trying and relaxed, and the whispers rushed back. I could understand now why I had been unable to hear them more clearly by listening harder. They weren't a physical sound, but a brushing against my mental awareness. I resisted the urge to attempt to connect to any of them, or to the people behind them, as I usually did with Lily. Instead, I replicated my earlier efforts, opening my mind to an extra awareness and focusing merely on being receptive.
"Aren't you finished yet?"
"Sorry, Gilda."
The voice sounded young, like a child, and guilty.
"You always say that, and yet you're always slow. How sorry can you really be?"
I detected a note of affection under Gilda's harsh words. I expanded my awareness.
"So then he invited me to go walking with him after the chores are done."
"He didn't."
"Really?"
Several mental giggles sounded along with the words. I crawled forward to peer into the kitchen again. It was a different sort of listening from what I was used to with Lily. With my twin, it took no effort at all, a mental connection that bonded me directly to her and required the merest thought from either of us to spring into being. This felt more like opening a new set of mental ears to the general chatter of the world. I could feel no sense of the person behind the words, and I had no channel to receive an impression of their emotions or well-being, like I usually did with Lily. But I found with concentration I could tell the direction the voices came from. I identified that the voices of the girls giggling over one of the grooms came from several sinks where dishes appeared to wash themselves, and that the voices of Gilda and the boy came from a silver fork that was being polished by an industrious cloth floating in the air. Matthew, the one who had sounded so much like my old stable master, hadn't spoken again, so I couldn't be sure where he might be positioned. For all I knew, he had left the room. A loud mental gasp rang out, but it ended too quickly for me to tell where it had come from. I recognised the shocked response as coming from Gilda, however.
"It's Princess Sophia!"
I had been caught. I bit my lip and looked around the room at the flying items, not sure where to direct my gaze.
"Where? I want to see her!"
"What's she doing here?"
"What's she doing on the floor?" A flush crept up my face at my foolish position. I scrambled up off my hands and knees and stepped into the room.
"Good evening,"
I said aloud with as much confidence as I could muster while brushing off my hands.
"I don't suppose someone could find me some food?"
"She's speaking to us."
"Well, not to us, exactly. One of the chambermaids told me that she sometimes speaks to the castle. She's very polite, apparently."
"Except the prince. I heard she told him off."
"Told off the prince? I wouldn't dare."
"Well, of course you wouldn't, as is right. You're a scullery maid, not a princess." Gilda sounded disapproving of the girls, but did nothing to silence their conversation, obviously as certain as the rest that I couldn't hear them.
"Oh, and you would, Gilda?"
I thought I recognised the defiant Tara. "He was scary even before the curse."
"As scary as he was handsome," said one of the gigglers.
"I think she must be very brave,"
added Tara, and my heart instantly warmed to her.
"She's as beautiful as we'd hoped," said a voice I didn't recognise.
"But why was she crawling around on the floor?" The last voice sounded much more doubtful about me than the others. I cleared my throat.
"I apologise for disturbing you, but I would greatly appreciate some food if you could find some. Just some bread and cheese would be sufficient."
"I don't know that His Highness would want us to feed her after she refuses invitation." Gilda sounded torn. I suppressed a snort. Invitation. That was one name for his curt command.
"But she's a princess, Gilda. Surely we can't disobey her."
I got the distinct impression Tara was merely attempting to distress the more senior woman.
"We can hardly let our royal guest starve," said the voice I recognised as Matthew. "And she's to be our mistress, is she not? Seems to me she's as much right as any to be giving orders around here."
"I'm not sure that His Highness would see it quite that way," said the earlier doubting voice. He seemed to be located near Matthew, and I wondered if he was a footman or a groom. My stomach grumbled loudly, and I lost my patience.
"I don't care how His Highness sees it. I am not the beast's prisoner, and I will not be constrained by his orders."
Shocked silence filled the room.
Chapter 8.
Can she hear us?
Impossible.
But the doubting footman or groom didn't sound quite sure. "Certainly I can hear you," I said calmly, as if such a circumstance was to be expected.
"She must truly be the one."
The scullery maid sounded breathless.
"The one? What one?" "Never mind their babble, Your Highness," said Gilda quickly, clearly trying to turn the subject. "Have a seat and let me get you some food. I'm sure we can find something more suitable than bread and cheese."
"Truly, I don't want to be a bother."
I was grateful for my years of practice with Lily, because it felt strange speaking aloud in response to a mental projection. But I wasn't confident I could project in the general way they did. I felt grateful enough I had worked out how to hear them.
"Bother? No, indeed. You must forgive our foolish words before."
Ah, Gilda's change of tone now made sense. She must be scrambling to remember what they had all said previously. But I had no desire to alienate the first people I had spoken to in days, excluding the beast, of course.
Thank you, and I can't imagine what you mean.
Please, have a seat. The kitchen tables were lined with long benches that could be tucked away when not in use, but the head and foot had wide, elaborately carved wooden chairs. One of them scraped backwards, presumably pulled out by one of the invisible servants, and I carefully made my way toward it. I hadn't collided with anyone in my days at the castle, so I assumed they had all been making some effort to avoid me. But walking among them still made me uncomfortable. I had to resist the urge to stretch my arms out in front of me as I moved. As I sat, sudden conversation burst out all around me, along with a flurry of sound from various plates and pots and cupboards. Trying to follow their words alongside the cacophony of actual noise hurt my head. I let my concentration drop away, and the words faded back into whispers. I could only hope it became easier with practice, or I would spend each day in a perpetual headache. When I realized a platter of food had been hovering beside me for some time, I started and reopened my awareness.
"Apologies, Your Highness. Is something not to your liking?"
The tone sounded a little snide, and I was almost certain it belonged to the doubter from earlier. A footman, then.
"No, indeed. I apologize. It looks delicious."
The food started travelling from the platter to my plate on a large silver spoon. I watched it, too fascinated to look away.
"May I ask your name?"
"Connor, Your Highness."
Several other voices started talking at once, and I held up my hand. Silence fell.
"I'm afraid it's rather difficult to follow a conversation when you can't see any of the speakers."
My connection with Lily was so close that I didn't need her body language to understand her words. Plus, there was only one of her. It was astonishingly difficult to follow an invisible group such as this.
"I'll need you to project a bit more slowly, and one at a time."
"Project? What do you mean?"
The curious child's voice sounded from the far corner of the room, where he had no doubt been banished following my arrival.
"Hush, Gordon. Don't disturb Her Highness." I could have anticipated Gilda's rushed response.
"No, it's fine. I don't mind."
I looked in the direction of the voice.
"Gordon, is it?"
After a moment of silence, one of the scullery maids whispered,
"She can't see you, idiot."
And Gordon mumbled a quick,
"Yes, Your Highness."
I grinned, sure he must have initially nodded in response.
"I don't hear you with my ears, but rather in my mind. Projecting is merely what I call such communication, when you send out your thoughts rather than speaking aloud."
"I don't know anything about thoughts."
Gordon sounded confused.
"I'm just speaking like always."
"Oh."
I looked around, wishing I wasn't surveying a room of empty air.
"I think someone needs to tell me exactly what is going on here."
Silence reigned, and I imagined them all looking at each other, wondering who was going to speak. I had already pictured faces for them all. I couldn't help myself.
"Well, Your Highness," said Matthew at last, "it seems we've all been caught up in some sort of curse."
His voice hesitated strangely over the word, and my brows drew together.
"As best we can tell, we've all been sort of moved sideways. Into some other realm, I suppose."
He sounded uneasy with the talk of other realms.
"We can see, hear, and interact with each other like normal, and we can interact with objects just fine. But we soon discovered no one outside Palinar can see or hear us at all. We have our animals with us, even."
He paused, and I thought of the coach that I had assumed to be horse and driverless.
"Which is why we weren't expecting Your Highness to be so astute, and why we know nothing of this projection you speak of."
He paused again, as if hoping for some sort of explanation. But I remained silent, unwilling to tell him of my gift. When he said nothing more, I prodded him.
"But why have you been cursed?"
Another moment of awkward silence, and then Gilda rushed in.
"Well, as to that, Your Highness, who can say?
Certainly not the likes of us.
I frowned.
It was easy to tell they knew more than they were saying. I let it go for now.
But what if the...